From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Move her! To get
a deal! Move her back away from the skirmish line or you're under arrest!
This way!
You can't do that! You cannot do that! You know that!
Journalists covering the May Day immigrant rights march are among those assaulted by police in Los Angeles. We'll see a report by a local L.A. station of its correspondent being thrown to the ground by the Los Angeles police. We'll speak with a journalist who was shot with a rubber bullet. But first, a look at Darfur.
What I saw in Darfur is a disaster and a shame to mankind. The international community, as Rwanda has been abandoned, Darfur is also abandoned.
Paul Rusesabagina, the Rwandan hotel manager, speaking about Darfur last year. Today, the man who played him in the movie Hotel Rwanda, actor Don Cheadle, will join us, along with renowned human rights activist John Prendergast, to talk about their new book, Not On Our Watch. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Capitol Hill, the Democratic-controlled House has failed to override President Bush's veto of an Iraq war spending bill that sets timetables for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq. After the override failed, President Bush hosted congressional leaders from both parties at the White House to discuss a compromise bill. The Washington Post is reporting the Democratic leadership is now backing down and has dropped their demand for including a timeline to bring troops home from Iraq. Democrats appear to be deeply divided over how far to give in to the White House. This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I had hoped that the president would see the light instead of turning a tin ear to the wishes of the American people and a blind eye to what is happening on the ground in Iraq. The president, in his signing, is reporting that progress is being made in Iraq. Well, I don't know what his definition of progress is, but sadly, April was the deadliest month, 100 troops of our troops killed there.
Meanwhile, Republican Congress member Jerry Lewis of California urged Democrats to fully fund the war.
I say to my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, you've made your point. You've had your dog and pony show. You've posed for political holy pictures on TV. Now what is your plan to support the troops? It is time to put the posturing and political stunts aside and do what is the best in the best interest of our troops.
In Iraq, nearly 4,000 more U.S. soldiers have arrived in Baghdad in an attempt to stabilize the city. Despite the so-called surge, another 85 Iraqis died on Wednesday. The heavily fortified Green Zone has come under mortar and rocket attacks for the past 3 days. Last night, four Filipino contractors working for the U.S. government were killed in a rocket attack inside the Green Zone. Meanwhile, a two-day conference over the future of Iraq has opened in the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. The U.S., Syria, and Iran are among the countries attending. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is expected to meet with Syria's foreign minister in the first high-level talks between the two countries in years. Protests are continuing in Afghanistan for a fifth day in a row over the killing of civilians by U.S. troops. Afghan officials say over 50 civilians have been killed in raids by U.S.-led troops against the Taliban in the past week. In the city of Nangarhar, 2,000 students rallied Wednesday. The students burned and stamped on U.S. flags and chanted, "Death to America." One of the protesters, Jamaluddin Khan, called for U.S. troops to leave Afghanistan.
As the foreign troops fail to bring security to Afghanistan, we want them to leave Afghanistan as soon as possible, without any preconditions. If they do not take our demand seriously, we will continue our protest.
Protesters have also called for the removal of the U.S.-backed Afghan president, Hamid Karzai. Karzai said Afghans no longer have patience for the killing of civilians by Western forces hunting the Taliban.
Unfortunately, the suffering of Afghanistan and certain parts of the country has not ended. We still suffer, either by the operations of terrorists or in the consequence of operations by NATO.
Meanwhile, one of Afghanistan's former prime ministers was shot and killed outside his home in Kabul Wednesday. Abdul Sabur Farid briefly served as prime minister 15 years ago. He'd been serving in Afghanistan's upper house of parliament. The Los Angeles Police Department is coming under increasing criticism for violently crushing a largely peaceful immigrant rights protest on Tuesday. Police dressed in riot gear fired 240 rounds of rubber and foam bullets as well as tear gas. Officers were seen on video clubbing protesters and journalists with batons. Overall, 10 people, including several journalists, were taken to hospitals after being injured. The Spanish-language TV station Telemundo confirmed one of its reporters and three camera operators had been injured by police. The Los Angeles Times reported four employees of KVEA-TV were injured. A KTTV news reporter suffered a minor shoulder injury. A camerawoman with KTTV also broke her wrist. Patricia Nazario of the public radio station KPCC was also injured. On Wednesday, Nazario described what had happened to her, and we'll play that later in the broadcast. The police have launched a pair of investigations. L.A. Police Chief William Bratton admitted the actions taken by the police were inappropriate. He said, quote, "I was disturbed what I saw." The police claimed they were provoked by some protesters who threw small objects at them. Councilman Herb Wesson likened what he saw to the violent police response to civil rights demonstrators in the South half a century ago. Wesson said, quote, "I had a flashback to 45 years ago. It was a nightmare to me." Lawmakers in Oklahoma have sent the state's governor a bill that's been described as one of the most sweeping anti-immigrant laws in the country. The bill would make it a felony in Oklahoma for anyone to harbor or transport people they know to be undocumented immigrants. Violators of the law could be punished by up to a year in jail. Critics of the bill say it could result in the jailing of medical staff and religious workers who offer aid to undocumented immigrants. In Washington, there have been several developments in the growing scandal over how the Bush administration has tried to transform the Justice Department into a political arm of the White House. The Justice Department has launched an internal investigation into whether the department's former liaison to the White House, Monica Goodling, illegally screened job applicants based on their political party affiliation. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee has subpoenaed Attorney General Berto Gonzalez to turn over all emails to or from White House advisor Karl Rove in connection with the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. The White House has claimed their copies of the emails have been lost. Colombian President Alvaro Uribe is in Washington, D.C. in an effort to win support for a new trade deal and continued support for Plan Colombia. The U.S. has given Colombia more than $5 billion since 2000. Some Democratic lawmakers and human rights groups have urged the Bush administration to reconsider its ties to the Colombian government following disclosures linking it to right-wing paramilitary death squads. Last month, Senator Patrick Leahy blocked the release of $55 million in aid because of Colombia's human rights record. On Wednesday, President Bush urged Congress to okay the agreements.
This agreement is good for the United States. It's good for job creators, farmers, workers. This agreement is good for Colombia. It's good for job creators and workers and farmers. This agreement has strategic implications. It is very important for this nation to stand with democracies that protect human rights and human dignity, democracies based upon the rule of law.
The Colombian government has hired the lobbying firm, the Glover Park Group, in an effort to win congressional support. The lobbying firm has close ties to the Democratic Party. Its founders include former Clinton White House spokesperson Joe Lockhart and several former strategists of Al Gore. Meanwhile, Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez urged lawmakers on Wednesday to approve new trade agreements with not just Colombia, but also Panama, Peru, and South Korea. Gutierrez attacked Latin American critics of trade deals with Washington.
There's some in the region that seem to have hijacked the term social justice. And it almost is as though, you know, it's a copyright that's used by the socialist radical left, as if though they understood the real meaning of social justice. And under the guise of social justice, They're implementing policies that we know are going to hurt their people and ultimately are going to hurt the economy. And at best, they will make everyone poor.
In other news from Latin America, the Bolivian government has moved a step closer to nationalizing its energy resources. On Wednesday, Bolivian President Evo Morales met with representatives from 12 different oil and gas companies to sign new contracts turning over production to the state. This is Carlos Villegas, Bolivia's Minister of Hydrocarbons.
The nationalization, the history of the oil in the country in the past year is entering a new phase. It's a phase of expectation and hope. We hope that through the official ratification of the contracts, we can solidify new investments and count on higher volumes of oil and natural gas.
In Somalia, the U.S.-backed transitional government has installed one of the country's most feared and ruthless warlords as the new mayor of Mogadishu, Mohamed Deir. According to the Associated Press, Deir has long cooperated with the CIA. And in news from Israel, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert held an emergency meeting of his cabinet Wednesday amidst growing calls for him to resign over his handling of the Lebanon war. Israel's foreign minister, Tzipi Livni, has urged Olmert to resign. Earlier today, opposition leader Benjamin Netanyahu said the public has lost all trust in Olmert's government. Palestinian senior negotiator Saab Erekat said the political controversy in Israel would likely affect the Palestinians.
I hope that the complexities that we're witnessing in Israel will not have a negative impact on our attempts and the quartet's attempt to revive a meaningful peace process. I hope we will not find ourselves in a vacuum, and everything that we're trying to do in terms of Secretary Rice's efforts to revive a meaningful peace process, to open a political horizon, will just be undermined.
Meanwhile, Israeli police have accused a former Arab member of the Knesset of treason and espionage. Israeli officials claim the lawmaker, Azmi Bashara, aided members of Hezbollah during the last summer's war. Bashara resigned his post, left the country last month. Police say Bashara will be arrested immediately if he returns to Israel. Bashara has described the charges as ridiculous. He said, quote, "Unlike those in Israel's parliament who have been involved in acts of violence, I have never used violence or participated in wars. My instruments of persuasion, in contrast, are simply words in books, articles, and speeches." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Well, for the first time, the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for crimes allegedly committed in the conflict in Darfur. Sudanese Humanitarian Affairs Minister Ahmed Mohamed Haroun and a Janjaweed militia leader known as Ali Kushaib are accused of crimes against humanity and war crimes. The charges center around their alleged roles in joint attacks in West Darfur that killed hundreds of civilians. The Sudanese government says it has no intention of handing over the accused pair. More than 200,000 people have been killed and 2.5 million displaced in fighting between rebels and government-backed militias since early 2003. A 7,000-strong African Union contingent is conducting a peacekeeping mission in the region with logistic support from NATO. This past weekend, protests were held around the world to call for more international action to end the mass killings in Darfur.
We're joined now by two leading voices in the Save Darfur movement. Don Cheadle is the Academy Award-nominated actor whose films include Hotel Rwanda, Traffic, Crash, and Rain Over Me. John Prendergast is a senior advisor to the International Crisis Group, one of the leaders of the Enough campaign. He worked at the White House and State Department during the Clinton administration. He travels regularly to Africa's war zones. John Prendergast and Don Cheadle have just co-authored a new book. It's called Not on Our Watch, The Mission to End Genocide in Darfur and Beyond. I want to begin with John Prendergast and ask you, you worked under the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration refused to call what was happening in Rwanda a genocide until it was too late, though you weren't there at the time. The Bush administration has called what's happening in Darfur a genocide. Yet, what is it doing about it? What's the difference whether they call it that or not?
Well, apparently not much. The convention is a vague document, the Genocide Convention, but it does, in fact, have one specific operative phrase, and that is that the signatory states must do all that they can to punish the crime of genocide. And for 4 years, we've had no accountability for those that have perpetrated and orchestrated this most heinous crime. So that's really the bottom line. Is the Bush administration going to impose punitive measures on the government of Sudan or not?
Don Cheadle, you, of course, received an Academy Award nomination for your portrayal of Paul Rusesabagina, the Rwandan hotel manager who's credited with saving 1,200 Rwandans from slaughter. He has also joined the movement to call attention to Darfur. He spoke at a rally in Washington, D.C. just over a year ago.
More than 12 years ago, in Rwanda, a militia was slaughtering innocent civilians on the hills, in the cities and towns. Today, last year I went to Darfur. What I saw in Darfur is exactly what was going on in Rwanda during that time. More than 2 million people displaced, without food, without shelter, without water, without education, which is the basic need for our future generations. Without any other hope. Ladies and gentlemen, what I saw in Darfur is a disaster and a shame to mankind. The international community, as Rwanda has been abandoned, Darfur is also abandoned.
Paul Rusesabagina, the Rwandan hotel manager who Don Cheadle played in Hotel Rwanda. As you were making this film, the foundation was being laid for the genocide in Darfur. How did you go from Rwanda to Darfur, Don?
Well, we had a screening of the film at an MGM facility in California, and Congressman Ed Royce from Orange County saw the film, and he and I met, and he told me that he had been trying to draw attention to the conflict in Darfur and believed that the film was a good example of what was happening depicted the story in a way that he could bring others to understand what was happening, and invited me to go with he and several other congresspersons on a congressional delegation to the area to see for myself what was happening. And John Prendergast came along, and we toured the camps, and I was able to get a firsthand accounting of what happened. And once I had seen with my own eyes and understood and listened to these people's stories, it was very hard to just return to my comfortable life and not do anything when I had the opportunity to do a lot more.
John Prendergast, I'd like to ask you about the International Criminal Court. Clearly, the Bush administration has had a very antagonistic view of the criminal court. How now, with this new finding, will the Bush administration deal with the reality that at the same time it's been opposing the International Criminal Court on the world stage?
Well, the United States government, the Bush administration, has a whole lot of potential leverage that it's squandering by its non-cooperation with the court. We don't expect the Bush administration to sign the treaty, but we could, in fact, expect the administration to provide some declassified intelligence and information to the court in order to accelerate the indictments of some other senior officials within the regime that are more responsible for orchestrating the genocidal crimes that have been committed in Darfur. That, I think, is one of the most pressing policy imperatives today, is to have the Bush administration quietly cooperate by providing information to the court to finally impose a cost for committing genocide.
A while ago, the Los Angeles Times, John, did a major expose that revealed that the U.S. has quietly forged a close intelligence partnership with Sudan, despite the government's role in the mass killing in Darfur. The Sudanese government has since publicly confirmed it's working with the Bush administration and the CIA. Can you talk about that relationship that they have in the so-called war on terror and how that relates to the killings in Darfur?
Well, in the early to mid-1990s, at the invitation of the Sudanese government, Osama bin Laden lived in Sudan, and a number of other terrorists either lived or transversed throughout Sudan on Sudanese passports. obviously the ultimate dream of a terrorist organization is to have a state sponsor, because you get all the accoutrements of the state. And Al-Qaeda benefited greatly in its incubation period from its residency in Khartoum. And so, although later, after the United States and other countries pressured the Sudanese regime to cut its ties, the regime did retain all of its very, very valuable records about all of the networks, the businesses, and the individuals and their aliases operating in many of the terrorist groups that the United States now, along with other partners around the world, is working against. So I think Sudan has become invaluable as one of the many governments around the world that are cooperating with the United States in terrorism, and clearly the Bush administration prioritizes that over everything else and has been unable to pursue at the same time a policy that maximizes cooperation on the counterterrorism front whilst trying to bring an end to this genocide.
We're talking to John Prendergast and Don Cheadle. We'll be back with them after this break. We're talking Darfur.
على بيننا واشيا كذب أو مفندا يخلق الريب ما لا واحتجب ودع الغضب ليت هاجري يشرح السبب كلما مشى أخجل القطب بين عينيه.
Music from Abdel Gadir Salim All Stars, the Sudanese musical group. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk with Don Cheadle, Academy Award-nominated actor whose films include Hotel Rwanda, among others, and John Prendergast, who is a senior advisor to the International Crisis Group. Both have traveled to Darfur. Juan?
Don Cheadle, I'd like to ask you, why Darfur? Clearly, there have been in Africa many conflicts that have taken huge numbers of lives, certainly the Congo, the civil war in the Congo in recent years. And right here in the United States, we're confronting mass killings occurring on a daily basis in Iraq. That some people would say that the movement for Darfur to highlight the genocide in Darfur is at the same time not dealing with what our own country is doing in Iraq. Why did you feel it's so important to raise this issue?
Well, I don't think I think people are sensitized to do what they are called to do, and I was with regards to Darfur, maybe because of the similarities of what I just experienced, even fictitiously with Hotel Rwanda. But I believe that genocide is the highest crime that humanity has to face. And if we are going to call it by its rightful name, which is the first time we've ever had a sitting president do that, then there should be an action that results from that. And if we do not strenuously attempt to interject ourselves into this process and quash this, then I just think it sends a terrible signal to everyone in the world that these crimes can go unpunished, and that when something like this occurs, you cannot look to the international world body to intervene. I believe it emboldens people who would want to do it in the future. And it is, again, as I say, it's the highest crime that I believe humanity can commit. And we want the entire world to stand on notice and attempt to put it down.
Don Cheadle, describe what it was like to travel to Darfur. What route did you take?
Well, we came in at first, we came through Chad, and then we crossed near an AU, one of the AU missions where the AU was, located, excuse me. And we just went through one of the villages there that had, prior to our arrival, had 40,000, or 4,000, rather, members there. And it had been burned out, huts had been abandoned, things were just left in a state of, you could tell people had just left with whatever they could carry. And it was just shocking and tragic, and to know that this was basically a ghost town that had been thriving and full of citizens not long before we had arrived.
John Prendergast, a question about corporate involvement. On May 5th, there's going to be the shareholders' meeting of Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett's company. Can you talk about corporations and their involvement in Sudan?
Well, there's corporations all over the world who, wherever there's money, they will go. And in Sudan, over the last 10 years, we've seen a rapidly escalating profit margin in the oil sector there. Sudan has gone from producing nothing but a few small agricultural products to now being a mid-level oil producer, which earns perhaps $4 or $5 billion a year in oil revenue, conservative estimates. And so you've got a lot of oil companies, particularly Chinese, Indian, and Malaysian, who have invested heavily during this last decade to ensure that this sector becomes as profitable as possible. And then there are a lot of ancillary companies that have invested. So in response to that, American citizens all over this country have began a process of what they call divestment, pressing for mutual funds for university endowments and state and municipal pension funds to sell the stock of companies that are doing business in Sudan and underwriting this genocidal regime. So you have at least now 9 states which have passed laws, governors have signed into law divestment measures. You have a number of universities all over the country that have done the same. And now, as you asked, Berkshire Hathaway, as one of the largest purchasers in the United States of the stock of the Chinese oil company that's the major investor in Sudan, shareholder activists are targeting Mr. Buffett and asking him to sell, to just dump the stock, the Chinese stock that's in his portfolio, and just buy some other energy company if he wants to remain diversified in that fashion.
John Prendergast, in your book, you also talk about the situation in Uganda and the Lord's Resistance Army. Could you talk about the relationship between the two crises?
Well, I think on the one hand, the relationship is that marked by some of the most terrible atrocities that we've ever heard about or seen. Both of us traveled to northern Uganda and to Darfur because we think that, in addition to Congo, these are two of the worst civil conflicts in the world. And on the other hand, the similarities are that, you know, we're talking about small groups of people who, given the motive, can do tremendous damage. And it doesn't require a massive army. It doesn't require billions of dollars in either case, in northern Uganda or in Darfur, to get a solution. It simply requires diplomatic leadership by the United States on the peace process in both places to help support some protection of people. Whatever that means. In Darfur, it means deploying a UN-led force. In Uganda, it means making sure the Ugandan army is not as abusive as it is. It means deploying human rights monitors. And then providing the leverage necessary, again, punishing the perpetrators using the International Criminal Court and other measures like targeted sanctions and asset freezes against those that would be willing to commit these kinds of crimes.
And Don Cheadle, there are some who say that this genocide is racially based, that it is largely Arab regime attacking a largely black African population. Others claim that this is simplistic, that there are many more class and historical factors involved. Your perspective?
Well, I think all of those are a factor. I do think it is racially based, but we're not talking about the largest percentage of the Arab population there. These are conscripted soldiers who do have a racist ideology, who have been funded to do what they're doing with the promises of the spoils of war. And they're taking advantage of that, obviously, to the GOS, the government of Sudan, is taking advantage of that to maintain power. So I just want to caution those to say this is Arabs versus Africans. This is the nature of this particular conflict. But again, it's a very small percentage that we're talking about that have been armed and have been unleashed on the civilian population.
I want to talk more about what proposals are on the table to end the killings in Darfur. Last September, we interviewed Alex DeWall, the specialist on Darfur and advisor to the African Union. The UN Security Council had recently voted to authorize more than 20,000 troops and police officers for Darfur, but the UN force was strongly rejected by the Sudanese government. This was what Alex DeWall had to say.
What President Bashir of Sudan has done is he's called the bluff of the UN and the US. The UN and the US have said, we want to send a force, and they've implied that if the Sudan government doesn't agree, they will force it on them. But what is the reality of this? Are we really going to send an army to Darfur to invade against the wishes of the Sudan government, to face the military resistance of the Sudan government and its militias? And the answer, frankly, is no. Are we going to be able to impose sanctions that are tough enough on the Sudan government, which has, after all, been under sanctions of one form or another for 17 years, that will make them comply? This is a country that is an oil exporter, that has good relations with all its neighbors now, has good relations with China and Russia. The answer, frankly, again, is no. So let's recognize that posturing and wielding a bigger stick, frankly, is not going to work. The bluff of that has been called. Let's get back to discussion. Let's get back to negotiating a political solution that starts with a ceasefire, that starts with saying, we can solve this problem, but we can solve this problem only with the consent of all. And the first step is the fighting must stop. And I personally am confident that this is the only way. It may be a long shot. Time is very short. We're really very, very close to some deadlines. And if we pass those deadlines, if we pass the end of this month and the African Union forces withdraw, then we're in a very, very dismal situation. But we do need to rescue this politically.
That was Harvard professor Alex DeWall. John Prendergast, your response.
Yeah, well, I think Alex is famous for setting up straw men and knocking them down. Nobody's talking about invading Sudan. What we're talking about is pressuring the government more robustly in order to accept a United Nations-led force to protect people while a peace agreement is negotiated. And I think that how you get there is doing... and we, Alex and I just simply disagree, is by imposing the kinds of measures that affect the Sudanese government's wallet and affect their calculations through the possibility that they will be prosecuted for war crimes for the rest of their lives. And so I think with this kind of leverage, we've seen three times in the last 18 years in the life of this government when real sanctions have been imposed or military threats have been preferred by the international community or the regional states, that Khartoum has actually changed its policies. So we have empirical evidence that when you pressure this government with real tools, with punitive measures, that they actually respond. But we haven't done that yet because of the counterterrorism connection that you talked about earlier. If we decide to move forward with these specific measures, we're going to see this government change its policies, allow the UN force to come in and stop the genocide. And it's time to undertake those measures now.
But John Prendergast, what about the situation with the, you talk about the Khartoum government, but the rebels themselves? Previous reports by UN-sponsored investigation have alleged war crimes being committed by the rebels themselves. It's not simply just a question of the government's attack on the civilian population.
Sure. I mean, the preponderance of attacks, preponderance of crimes against humanity have been committed by government forces or government-supported Janjaweed militias. The rebels are also responsible for some terrible attacks, and I think they should equally vigorously be prosecuted by the International Criminal Court for any actions of this nature, and we ought to impose sanctions on any of the rebel leaders who are either committing atrocities or undermining the peace process.
Paint a picture for us, John Prendergast. You have been in Darfur many times. How does the violence take place? Describe a village for us, someone that you have spoken to.
Sure. Well, the pattern is almost eerily similar every time. You know, the story normally starts at 4 or 5 in the morning when the Antonov bombers, the high-altitude aircraft, Russian-made bombers, Russian-sold bombers as well, initially buzz across above a town 2 or 3 times. Then they drop their payload and bomb the town from above. This destabilizes the town. People are running everywhere. And the Janjaweed militias storm in on horses and camel, and they kill and loot and rape with total impunity. And they're usually backed up by a government force on the outskirts of the village, sometimes small, sometimes large, depending on how large the village is. Now, this has happened 1,500 times. According to the satellite imagery that's been collected, which any viewer can go onto Google Earth and view just by typing in Darfur, that about 1,500 villages have either completely or partially been burned to the ground in this kind of an attack. So the survivors, the people who escape, then end up in these camps of thousands of people, whether internally displaced camps inside Darfur or in refugee camps across the border in Chad. And they are then highly vulnerable to the government of Sudan, usually, and sometimes the rebels, turning on and off the aid tap. So there's about 1 million people now in Darfur who are beyond any reach of the humanitarian aid agencies. So we just don't know what's going on in these areas. We simply don't know whether people are dying en masse, and it is an absolute critical emergency to undertake the kind of policies necessary to deal with this, or we could see the cataclysm of Darfur get even worse.
And Don Cheadle, I'd like to ask you, obviously you have taken a very high-profile position on this, so have several other Hollywood stars like George Clooney as well. What has been the impact in terms of being able to mobilize public opinion here in the United States, and is this having an effect on the public in other countries?
Well, I believe that I've seen, since I became involved years ago, much more awareness. I know that at the beginning when I was just mentioned the word Darfur to people, people wouldn't know what I was talking about, and I've seen a big change in that. And I can't speak for George or the other celebrities, but I know that I wanted to take the attention that's often given to me for whatever role I'm portraying and whatever job I happen to be doing, and just try to refract that and reflect that and point to something that I think is a grave cause and that we need to all pay attention to. And, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. We will see what this movement will do. We believe we're at a watershed moment in several ways. We have the 2008 Olympics coming up in Beijing, and we want to highlight China's connection to this problem and really have the public awareness about that and ask what China is doing. We want to inject this into the debate. We have an election coming up in this country, obviously, and six of the candidates, at least six of them, have either traveled to the region or written extensively about it. And we want to inject this question into the debate. What will be done? What is your policy toward this? And we have this Plan B, which is sitting, if not on the desk now, in the wings for our president to sign, which we believe will give some real teeth to this process and hopefully see a result. The EU has come out and said that by June, if nothing has been done, there will be something done. I mean, we haven't been at this moment in time until now, where all of these things sit at the precipice, hopefully, and we can push these things over and get some results.
Don Cheadle, you mentioned the presidential candidates. Your book has an introduction by Senator Sam Brownback and Senator Barack Obama. Barack Obama has been speaking out on Darfur. Would you say he has taken, of all the presidential candidates, the most aggressive stance on it? And what is it?
Well, Senator McCain is likewise spoken about this very strongly, as has Senator Clinton. And I believe they are all saying, the rhetoric is all the same, that this must be stopped. What we want to know is what beyond the rhetoric are we prepared to do? What will we be willing to do? I met lately with Secretary Rice, and she spoke to me about when they were trying to solve this Lebanon-Israel issue in the last year, that she sent a special, not an envoy necessarily, but she sent someone from her department to sit on the bureaucracy in the United Nations and push this through and make sure that this red tape was cut through and that there was a solution. And we believe that the situation in Darfur should at least get that same sort of consideration and that it should be raised to that level of importance. So we want to know what these candidates are willing to do and what they will go on record to say, and if they don't say it, that we hold their feet to the fire and press them on this issue. It's of grave importance to us.
And Don, could you talk about the role of young people here in the United States, college students and others who have become involved in this issue and their impact on the debate?
Well, one of the most rewarding things that I was able to witness up close, and we discuss him in our book, Adam Sterling with the Darfur Action Committee, who used to be before he graduated from UCLA, got together with several of his fellow students and asked themselves the question of what could they do. And they were the leaders in the divestment movement at that school, and not only in that school, but the entire UC schools, and they were able to push through divestment measures, and that rolled into, with Paul Koretz coming in, becoming involved, that happening at a state level. And he is now working with the Sudan Divestment Task Force to see that happens all across the country. And we're seeing real results, and this is coming from the youth movement. So I've been very heartened by what young people in this country are doing and have done, and I would encourage them to stay a part of the process, and I do believe we'll see results.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Don Cheadle, actor whose films include Hotel Rwanda, Traffic, Crash, Rain Over Me. He, together with John Prendergast, senior advisor to the International Crisis Group, one of the leaders of the Enough campaign, have co-authored the book Not On Our Watch, The Mission to End Genocide in Darfur and Beyond, including 6 ways you can help today. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to Los Angeles to the police response to the immigrants' rights protests on May Day. Gadir Salim Singers, the All-Stars. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
The Los Angeles Police Department is coming under increasing criticism for violently crushing a largely peaceful immigrant rights march on Tuesday. Police with riot guns fired 240 rounds, shot tear gas, and clubbed protesters and journalists gathered in MacArthur Park. At least 10 people were injured, including 7 journalists. Pedro Sekic was broadcasting live for Spanish language television network Telemundo when police knocked over his monitors and lights and hit his staff with batons. Sefcik told the Los Angeles Times a police officer grabbed one of his cameras and threw it more than 15 feet to the ground. He said police pointed a riot gun at his face, hit him with a baton, and forced him out of the park. Patricia Nazario of the public radio station KPCC was also injured. On Wednesday, Nazario described to listeners what happened to her.
The cop jammed me in my ribs with his billy club, and so I turned around square looking at him. I had my press pass on. I had my mic flag in my hand, my notepad, and my pen. And I said, "Why did you hit me? I'm a reporter." And he said, "Move." And I said, "I am moving. Why did you hit me? I'm a reporter." And he hit me again harder that time, and I fell.
Others assaulted included four employees of KVEA-TV, Channel 52, and a reporter for the public radio station KPCC, hit by a police baton. Cristina Gonzalez, a reporter for the Fox affiliate KTTV, Channel 11, suffered a bruised shoulder after she was shoved to the ground. Her camera operator suffered a broken wrist. The incident was caught on tape.
Police in riot gear moved into MacArthur Park after some protesters started throwing rocks and plastic bottles at officers. But this time, it was impossible for the news media to be impartial observers.
I am helping her move her! She can't see you!
Move her back away from the skirmish line or you're under arrest!
This way!
You can't do that! You cannot do that! You know that!
Go this way!
What
is your name?
It didn't stop with pushing and shoving. Police officers fired rubber bullets. Protesters say they had no warning that officers were moving in.
We are talking about an order to disperse, which I never heard. Neither did people getting hit by rubber bullets. That man was standing next to a colleague's network live shot, which got this.
A photographer was trying to capture all of the action when he was targeted by police. He's knocked over, then kicked. The officer even grabs and throws his camera. As our crew tries to move to safety, a police officer hits camera person Patty Ballard.
Here is a perspective from our colleagues at Univision. You see us on the right side of the screen. Patty goes down. I am trying to protect her, but they don't stop, even though I'm telling them we are trying to get to our truck a few feet away.
A report by Fox affiliate KTTV Channel 11. The LAPD says it gave orders to disperse, but several journalists and protesters have disputed the account. The order was made only in English, not even near the main crowd. LAPD Police Chief William Bratton admitted the actions taken by the police were inappropriate. He said, quote, "I was disturbed at what I saw." The LAPD has launched a pair of investigations. Several news groups say they're considering legal action. We go now to Los Angeles to two guests. Ernesto Arce is a correspondent for Pacifica radio station KPFK in Los Angeles. He was shot with a police rubber bullet at the May Day protest. Also on the line, Gerardo Gomez, counselor and homeless rights activist, who was shot twice at the protest. Ernesto Arce, let's begin with you. Where were you? What did you see?
Hi, good morning, Amy. I was at the southeast corner of the park, MacArthur Park, which I believe was at 7th and Alvarado. I was trying to get a sense of what was happening. I noticed that there was a lot of commotion at that end of the park. I noticed that a lot of people were running and fleeing. So I wanted to see what it was that was happening. I also wanted to, you know, get onto the Metro link to get home. But of course, I wasn't able to do that since there was a heavy police presence on Alvarado Street. It was then that I noticed that police, and I guess it was two different kinds of cops. There was the regular cops, and then there was the SWAT team, who had come in very shielded attire. They also were holding a rifle, what looked like rifles. They began to push people back from the very southeast corner of the park into the park. They were at first using batons, but I noticed that they began to shoot. I wasn't sure what type of, whether it was tear gas or whether they were actual, real bullets or rubber pellets. But many people were getting hit. It was at that time that people began to just, flee towards towards the north of the park. There was a lot of commotion. There was a lot of confusion. Hundreds of families were still there. Actually, at this end of the park, the main rally, which was attended by approximately 5,000 to 10,000 people organized by the MIWON, Multi-Ethnic Workers Coalition, was still going on at this time. It hadn't been broken up. So there were still several hundred families, even on the south end of this, south side of this park. A lot of people were running, screaming. There were families. There were children. There's a large transient population that lives at MacArthur Park, a lot of homeless individuals, handicapped individuals, and, of course, streetcar vendors that sell different fares, whether ice cream or hot dogs. And they were unable to get out on time, and the police were relentless. They were merciless. They would hit anyone in their path. They would shoot at anyone. Actually, a lot of people were shot on the back, including myself. It was total chaos. And again, another example of Los Angeles Police Department brutality.
Ernesto, from what you were able to tell, what touched off this disproportionate response, given the fact that, for instance, last year, half a million people marched in Los Angeles in the biggest protest in that state's history, and now with this much smaller crowd, the police reacted in this way?
Well, it seems like they were trying to clear Alvarado Street for ongoing traffic. And there was a circle of people that were gathered around Aztec danzantes, or pre-Columbian Mexican dancers, and they were holding a ceremony. And a police on motorcade decided to forcibly break that up, and they drove their motorcycles through this crowd. They were followed by police on bike and followed by more police on foot. The police on bike and the police on foot forcibly removed the people. I think there was some resistance because I think the Aztec dancers weren't able to pick up their ceremonial processions and some of the things that they had with them, drums, etc. And they weren't able to move quickly enough. I know several people were pushed over onto the ground by the police. And they weren't able to make it, onto the sidewalk as the police were demanding. So I think there was definitely that original skirmish, which happened approximately 30 minutes after the march concluded or arrived at MacArthur Park at approximately 5:30.
In addition to Ernesto Arce, correspondent with KPFK, Pacifica radio station in Los Angeles, who himself was shot with a rubber bullet, we're joined by Gerardo Gomez, a counselor and homeless rights activist in Los Angeles, shot twice with rubber bullets by the LAPD. Gerardo, describe exactly what happened to you, where you were, what point of the protest, and how you got shot.
I was there around about 5:40 on close to the corner of 7th and Alvarado. And I was just a spectator, just on the sidewalk by the park. When about maybe 15 minutes later, I don't know, where we see cops like pushing the people out of the park and throwing tear gases and rubber bullets. And the first time I got shot, I would say I was probably maybe 400 feet away, and I got hit. And then I just started panicking and started running. I went to the other side of the park, which was the east side of 7th and Alvarado, like on the soccer side. That's when, those are the images that's been showing on TV, where, like, it's on the soccer field and the cops just started, like, just harassing the people and not giving any orders and then shooting at people. The second time that I got shot, I was very close to the Spanish cameraman who got hit with the bullet, and because he wasn't able to get up, he got hit with batons. So the second time I got hit, I was like 50 feet away, and I rolled down, and I was in pain, but if I didn't get up on time, I was going to get hit again. And I want to remind you that what they did yesterday, it's totally inappropriate, and I know that there have been mentioned reports that there was like, they're trying to blame it on these young anarchists, but in reality, the cops got caught, and the fact that they got caught and that it's in the videos, they're trying to find someone to blame it for. So it's easy for them to say, let's blame it on young anarchists, and that's not right. They didn't give no warnings, they didn't give nothing, and with the people in LA, we're asking the resignation of Chief Braddon, because what he's been doing, it's the same thing that he did in New York with the Million Youth March on September 5th, 1998. And it was the exact same scenario. And we saw what he did with the homeless people in Times Square. That's exactly what he's doing here in Skid Row, trying to push the homeless people away. And then with his police brutalities, the Susie Pena case, the Devin Brown case, all these actions are inappropriate. And for him to get another five-year term, that's inappropriate. But we're not only just asking for the resignation of Chief Braddon, but we're asking for the city of LA to change the way the system works, the policing system works. And we're asking for a different approach. In the state of Guerrero, what they do, the cops, it's the community who runs the cops. They realize that the police system is so corrupt, so it's a voluntary program. So it's the community themselves. They're controlling their own like neighborhood. And when a family goes out to patrol the streets, the community helps the family by providing them with beans and rice. And that's what we're trying to let the city of LA know, that we're not just asking for the resignation of Chief Braddon, but we're asking for them to change the policing system. Because what they did on May Day, they instigated fear on us, but what they did, they reassured to us that we cannot trust the police.
Ernesto Arce, let me ask you a question. The police commissioner Braddon, formerly here in New York, the police commissioner. The mayor, Villaraigosa, he was in El Salvador during the May Day protests. Where is he now and what has he said?
From what I heard, the mayor was on a 7 or 8 day tour of Latin America, actually just two countries, Mexico and El Salvador. He's meeting with Mexican President Felipe Calderon, as well as Salvadoran President Tony Saca. And they're mostly there to mention, or mostly there to talk about business deals, as well as what they call the transnational gang threat, which is essentially las maras, or the gangs that have crossed from one nation to another. His original response was that he thought it was unfortunate, and he's calling for a full, transparent investigation. But he has completely supported Chief Braddon in the past, and he did offer words of encouragement. And he said that everything was being done to investigate the situation, and that he would be returning pretty soon.
And Ernesto, for those folks who are not familiar with Los Angeles, could you talk about the importance of MacArthur Park? This has been a site in over decades of many protests in the Latino community, hasn't it?
That's right. It's actually named after General MacArthur, who I suppose was a war hero during the Korean War. It's really it's similar to New York Central Park. It's probably the largest park in Los Angeles County, or rather within Los Angeles city limits. Again, I'm not exactly sure what the size is, but it's a really large park. It's in the Westlake neighborhood, which has since maybe the late or mid 80s has been home to predominantly Central American and Latino immigrants. It's in a very impoverished and neglected, underserved neighborhood, and there has been many protests at MacArthur Park. I know some of the Filipino World War II veterans held protests there every year. Of course, many immigrant rights protests are held there at MacArthur Park. Last year, one of the two main rallies on May Day was organized there at MacArthur Park. It's a site for a lot of different activities.
Ernesto, we only have a second, but what about those who want to talk about what happened to them, but this was an immigrants' rights protest, afraid perhaps of being identified, of being targeted for being undocumented?
Yeah, and I think that's the problem. I think we held a special program here in Los Angeles yesterday. And a lot
5 seconds.
That were, they were terrified to move forward and to actually, file reports against the police.
Ernesto Arce, I want to thank you very much for being with us, as well as Gerardo Gomez. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go there for transcript, audio, and video podcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!